Labor Day deals are looking good at Lowe's. Save $10 on 1 gallon cans and $50 on 5 gallon pails of select interior paint via rebate. Plus, get two 2.5 quart or 3 quart Mums for just $8. A fresh look and savings? Even better. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Mum sizes vary by location and exclude Alaska and Hawaii. See store at Lowe's.com for more details.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
The cruise ship murder. Anna Kempner's 16-year-old stepbrother has been indicted as an adult on charges of first-degree murder and aggravated S abuse. But it's what the defense did that nobody is talking about. Newly unsealed court records show the accused signed a written waiver requesting to be prosecuted as an adult, giving up the right to fight the transfer or appeal it. His attorney co-signed it for a teenager now facing life in federal prison. That signature raises a question I think we deserve an answer to. Why would you volunteer for that? Because it's the right thing to do? Is that what's going on here? There's a lot of questions I have about the levers that are being pulled in this case. Joining us to discuss, of course, my co-host Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agency for the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, and Eric Faddis is with us, defense attorney and former prosecutor. Eric, help us make sense of this. Most people here charged as an adult and assumed the prosecution forced it or the court said this is what we're going to be doing. But the court records show the kid signed a waiver asking to be tried as an adult and the defense team co-signed it. Why on earth would a defense attorney let a 16-year-old facing life in prison volunteer for that? Or is this, did they really not have much of a choice in the matter when it came down to it?
Tony, this is a real head scratcher. It's hard to envision what benefits a criminal defendant originally charged as a juvenile would receive if they voluntarily wanted to really escalate their case to being charged as an adult. The only thing that kind of comes to mind is perhaps they thought that the public defenders in the adult division may be more skilled, may be more experienced in homicide cases than the public defenders in the juvenile division. But you're also taking a tremendous risk in terms of sentencing exposure and a number of other items.
Eric, I'm curious, do you think, again, just going on the behavior side of things, do you think if they thought, because it looks like there's a lot of obviously very overwhelming evidence against this 16-year-old, right? If they thought that it was so overwhelming, and Bob said it the other day too, Bob Mata said, you know, when it goes federal, you're screwed just because they're so thorough in everything they do. If defense thought this was so overwhelming that they're going to lose no matter what, if it goes to a jury, do you think they might be trying, again, it's a huge gamble, do you think they might be trying to just appeal to some sympathy here, that saying, hey, it's a 16-year-old being tried as an adult, you know, give some leniency, give some plausible deniability, whatever. Do you think there's a possibility in there of that?
Perhaps there is a sympathetic narrative there. But the thing is, Robin, if it got to a jury trial, I doubt the jury would ever hear that the defendant personally elected to change this case from a juvenile case to an adult case against him. So I don't think he would get any dividends at the trial phase. You know, the judge would be aware of it. The judge is ultimately in control of sentencing. So perhaps that could be an angle, but overall, rather puzzling.
Would he put a B? I'm sorry, Tony, I heard you about to go.
Yeah, go ahead.
So here he is. So let's play forward, assuming he's sentenced. And even if he pleads out, either way, Is there any consideration for his age when put in a general population at a prison, or is he just going to be in there with every sex offender and everyone else in the world for whatever?
My understanding is that as a general rule, he'll be treated just like any other adult offender. Jeez. Now, if there are specific threats, if there are specific risks other than him just being younger while incarcerated, I think the warden or whoever is in control of the facility has the authority to have protective custody, to have measures in place to try to protect this young man should he be incarcerated. But generally speaking, he's probably just going to be in Gen Pop with all the rest of them, and that's a precarious situation for a 16, 17, 18-year-old.
Yeah.
I'm not accusing anyone of anything here, but I'm trying to figure out motivation. And I'm trying to figure out, okay, what inspired this to take place this way, other than the federal government's coming at you going, we have a very strong case. You might as well just, you know, toe the line and go along with this. We have accusations that have been made against the family of this is what the environment was like. We've seen in the custody hearings that are going on, which is what we know most of this case from, between the wife and the former the father of the accused son, which is that whole dynamic there. We've learned from the testimony of one of the kids that allegedly the father of Anna had put one of the kids into a chokehold, a bar hold, very similar to the way Anna allegedly died. There's a lot of confusion, or not confusion, but there's some very, you know, nasty allegations of how maybe parenting was done within that house. And these are allegations. I'm not saying it's anything criminal. But if you have this type of a case hovering around your family, and we've also seen, and I found this interesting, that the family is very eager to see the stepson face justice. Good. I mean, I guess, I mean, on the surface, that looks good. Like, great. Yes, let's have him face justice. It's rather odd coming from his side, but okay. Is there a motivating factor to get somebody charged here, for them to face consequences, for all the attention to go over here to the guy who's accused of the crime, and for less attention to be over here on the ether or the environment to which he was made? Is that possibly playing a factor here in terms of, here's what we're going to do? You should probably do this. I don't know. I'm just trying to think, parents talking to the 16-year-old, influencing decision-making processes here as to what we're going to sign, what we're not going to sign, what our strategy is going to be, what it's not going to be. I don't know. I'm just kind of get a feeling. I'm getting a weird feeling here that maybe the idea that, okay, he should face justice because he did these horrible things may not be as pure as it appears on the surface. That's just kind of my gut on this. I don't know.
Yeah, Tony, if any adult, especially in the family, influenced this 16-year-old to change the case from a juvenile case to an adult case against him, that would be a complete dereliction of duty as a parental figure, in my opinion. It is so contradictory to the legal interests of this suspect presently. But you know, in the juvenile system, they talk a lot more about what was the environment like, what were the mm-hmm. people around this individual like, what were the causal factors here, how did this happen? Whereas in the adult system, they care less about that. Prosecutors care less about that. Judges care less about that.
Yeah,
could that be some traction there? I mean, it's possible.
Yeah, I mean, it takes the magnifying glass off of the family quite a bit now, doesn't it? I mean, and look, I'm not saying anything criminal is happening at the home. I don't know. But it does seem that there was, in my opinion and the opinion of many people, not the greatest parenting going on. If in fact, this family had been warned about this type of behavior, which according to the ex-boyfriend of Anna, that they were, and it was ignored or brushed aside, or however you want to word lack of action taking place. And then the parents having this delusion of, it's the three amigos. Everybody's getting along great. Everybody's great. married, stay in the same room, la, 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 don't tell us any different. I don't know. I mean, that's kind of what we've seen a lot of in the buildup here. But if you get it to the adult court, none of that becomes an issue anymore. None of it's being talked about anymore. So it's certainly not necessarily in the legal interest, you know, if we're speaking of the 16-year-old, but it certainly is in the legal interest of the parents and the adults to get the attention away there. Just saying, again, not saying it's criminal. I mean, there's a lot of things in cases like this that are ethically bankrupt, morally bankrupt, but not necessarily legal or illegal or legally bankrupt. If it's a lever to pull, you may question, like, that's interesting. As a parent, you're pulling this lever. But again, not illegal. And again, not maybe necessarily covering up anything illegal, but shifting attention elsewhere.
And also, would it help? I totally, unless we have other things, and Gen Z and all the others in the chat are putting some really good other reasons in there, text messages and all that would back up this theory. I'm also curious, by them pleading, well, not pleading, by them saying willing to go and get tried as an adult, with Eric, would that actually help any kind of plea agreement as well, that they caved on this one or gave this as a carrot so that it could actually plead down something on the other side, maybe?
I think in a practical sense, it's doubtful. You know, we like to think that if a person comes forward and takes, you know, some modicum of responsibility or does the right thing during the pendency of a case, they might be entitled to some kind of goodwill because of that. Mm-hmm. But in a practical sense, I don't think the prosecutor is going to care at all. I don't think they're going to access any kind of leniency, especially with the egregiousness of the allegations here. So I doubt that there would be such a benefit along those lines.
So we're left with parental protection as a theory.
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. And again, I'm not accusing anything illegal. It's just, it's bizarre. It's bizarre the way that this has played out. And I don't know that everyone's intentions are as pure as they're appearing on the surface. Right now, the accused is not sitting in a jail cell. He's living with a relative wearing an ankle monitor and was recently allowed to work at his biological father's landscaping business. Prosecutors are calling him a danger to others. A lot of people cannot understand how someone facing these charges is not behind bars. Obviously, he was charged as a juvenile. That's just recently changed. Do we expect that to change too? Can you explain what's actually happening with his current release? And might that be up for some sort of amendment now that this is going to adult court?
100%, Tony, hit the nail on the head. And in fact, according to reports, prosecutors are already vying to revoke his bond. Their theory is that, hey, he was originally given bond under the juvenile system, under juvenile laws, which take into consideration different things than adult bail laws take into consideration. So the prosecutor is saying, hey, now not only is he, you know, alleged to have done these serious, egregious adult acts, but on top of that, his exposure, his potential sentence has just skyrocketed by decades and decades. That makes him more of a flight risk. That makes a person more of a flight risk than if they're in the juvenile system facing, you know, 7 years or something like that. So yes, I think the judge is going to have to address whether bond should be changed in this case. And I understand that defense is going to file a response to the prosecution's request.
Is his defense court appointed or is it private? Do you know?
That I'm not sure. My apprehension is that it would start out as a public assistance, like a public defender. But I can't say that for sure.
I'm just curious whether that weighed into it at all as well.
The scenario here of what took place at night, three teenagers supposedly sharing that cabin the night Anna Kempner was killed, not just the accused, but also Anna's 14-year-old brother, her biological brother. We've not heard a lot about what that kid experienced. We have heard accusations. Again, it's through people. I believe this was through Anna's boyfriend or ex-boyfriend, the one who had said that he had witnessed the victimizer, the one who's being accused here of breaking into her room and getting on top of her during a FaceTime call and then ran away. The accusations that the 14-year-old brother has made essentially state that he heard banging, he heard noises, he heard things coming out of that room that didn't sound, you know, like two people just chilling. How important is that testimony? How important is what that 14-year-old, who ended up sleeping on top of his dead sister without knowing it. She was below the bed. And he went to sleep in that cabin not knowing what had just taken place. I mean, that's going to be interesting testimony. I would imagine it would certainly come in here. I mean, how crucial is that? How damning could that be? Not only as to what he heard, but then going into that cabin, Anna's not there, but he goes to bed, and so does the stepbrother. And oh, well, maybe she'll come back to the room later. You know, no, just the preponderance of just normalcy that he seemed to walk into, and the alleged killer not saying a word, just everything's fine, everything's dandy. What's that going to be like?
That 14-year-old's testimony will likely be critical to this case for a number of reasons. One, you know, when you have an alleged incident that happened inside of a closed space and there are only two people involved and one of them's dead, well, we only have one story at that point in terms of what happened inside of that room. And that's from the suspect, who I believe is just basically claiming he doesn't remember anything. So the only other human who was privy to what was going on was this 14-year-old. So what did they hear? What did they see? Was it abnormal? Especially when the 14-year-old walked into the room, I'm curious, what observations were made? Did it look like there had been an altercation? Was there any blood or biological material observed? Did anything seem out of sorts or out of place? All of those things are going to be critical to trying to determine what happened inside that room.
Yeah, and to some of our viewers' comments, like Mark Fry, death has a smell. Especially when you're in that kind of close proximity, because when there's no muscles in the body working anymore, things are just released. So it's hard to imagine there wasn't some foulness about that cabin as well that would perk up someone's curiosity.
Unless they just told themselves, oh, that's the taste of Alaska buffet on the Lido deck. And that's all that is. It's just it's bad crab. I mean, people tell themselves a lot of things to not, you know, and their kids too, you know, the hindsight, that they'll be able to look and go, yeah, that was off. That wasn't normal. Your thoughts on this part of the case in the comment section, on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in there. Federal prosecutors say ship surveillance shows no one else entered or exited that stateroom the night Anna Kempner was killed. Her body was allegedly found concealed under a bed, wrapped in a blanket, covered with life jackets. The cause of death? Mechanical asphyxiation. The accused allegedly SA'd her and intentionally killed his stepsister while the Carnival Horizon was in international waters, which is why this case is in federal court, a system that almost never prosecutes minors as adults. Prosecutors say that they are going to they're going to be trying this case. Eric, when you got a case like this, you got cameras, there really isn't a lot of room for ambiguity here. I mean, we've seen crazy claims made, but I don't think this is a Lori Daybell case where Nephi's coming in and giving messages and, you know, people are turning into zombies or flying through porthole windows like Batman.
Yeah.
Pretty cut and dry. Yes. Yes, that's true. We haven't gotten there yet. When you have something this cut and dry where, okay, here's who's coming and going out of this door, we know who did this. She didn't do it to herself. Does this thing ever end up in a courtroom, or is there enough wiggle room here to take this thing to trial? Of not that he didn't do it, but he did it, and here's why. There's arguments of the prescription drugs, of not taking his sleeping medication, of possible alcohol involvement with a minor. Again, these are things that not necessarily make you into a homicidal maniac, but I guess could lead to poor decision making.
Sure. You know, certainly on paper at this juncture, it seems like a strong case. But there are some unanswered questions and some other considerations as well. Like you said, you know, my understanding is the suspect had a number of medications that he claims he had gone days without. You know, if a 16-year-old had been taking sleeping medications and things like that and then been without them for a number of days, that's going to have a physiological effect. Mm-hmm. Is that going to turn him into some, you know, sort of like catatonic zombie who didn't know what they were doing and was sleepwalking and engaged in some action? We have yet to see that. It's possible. On top of that, you know, is it possible that there was some accident that happened inside of that room? I'm not saying that's for sure how it went down, but I think defense is going to explore, you know, was there any kind of self-asphyxiation? Was there some weird game being played? You know, teens do a lot of bizarre stuff. I just think it's not as open and shut at this juncture as it might look on paper.
And does them allowing and saying, okay, I can be tried as an adult, help any of those defense strategies or hinder them? Or are they kind of neutral? Again, just trying to line up what would inspire them to say, all right, I can be tried as an adult. And or is that just them throwing in the white flag, you think?
It's hard to say. You know, I think a possible explanation is that they would have more control over their choice of counsel if they're going the public defender route. And like I said, you know, there are a lot fewer juvenile homicide cases than there are adult homicide cases. Right. The adult defense attorneys are more used to handling those. And especially at the federal level, juveniles are rarely prosecuted right. under the federal juvenile system. And so I guess perhaps they thought maybe I'd have a better shake with an attorney who's done, you know, 100 homicides than an attorney who hasn't done any.
Yeah, good points.
With this being that you have the possible arguments here for the medication, you may have arguments that he was served alcohol. Let's talk about that for a second, because that's important, but the pattern of behavior is also important. If they can show a pattern of behavior specifically from the former boyfriend or others who may be able to show a pattern that the stepbrother had not the purest of intent, as we borrow a word from Joseph Duggar, in other incidents.
Moral failings.
How damning might that be? And I have to run to the other room for a quick moment to grab something, but go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, I think if defense raises some defense of like, hey, these medications made the defendant out of their mind, unable to actually come to a mental state like knowingly killing somebody because they didn't know what they were doing because the meds got them all screwy. I think that the prosecution's definitely going to look at the history leading up to this and say, there's actually evidence of potential animosity, of potential hostility, of potential intent to harm, because there are at least allegedly, according to some reports, some kind of interactions between these two step siblings, leading up to this that might not have been the most savory of interactions. And so that sort of cuts against this freak pharmaceutical fugue state that the defense might argue that the suspect was in by saying, no, this is actually consistent with all the things he's done in the years and months leading up to this.
Yeah, and also all the text messages that they're going to be discoverable on it as well. And that goes then back to, you know, who's paying for the cell phone bills? Who's seeing this? Who has access to those text messages? Because again, I see it'll be really interesting because we talked about this the other day too. What kind of parental liabilities do you think are going to come into this? Kind of like, you know, school shooters that we're seeing these days too. Do you think they're going to try to rope in the parents right away, or will that be a secondary thing?
They're certainly going to look at that digital footprint. They're going to look because it sort of reconstructs the history of the relationship leading up to Anna Kempner's death. And so, in that digital footprint, is there influence from parental members? Do parental members have knowledge that some impending danger could take place and, they didn't take action? I haven't seen any such records. I'm just talking right. hypothetically that it's possible that, the parents were not the most noble actors in this ongoing familial relationship, and could that subject them to, the government putting an eye on them, or even in a civil realm, someone going after the parents by saying, hey, you saw the warning signs, you knew what was going to happen, you didn't take the appropriate action, this young woman is dead, and somebody's got to pay up. That we've seen it before, Robin.
Does him claiming and being willing to be tried as an adult help or hinder a parental defense at any point?
I don't think that in the criminal context there would be any sort of complete defense because my dad sucks or something like that. Mm-hmm. I think even if some adult did not handle things as responsibly as they should have, which I'm not necessarily saying happened, just hypothetically.
Yeah.
That is a part of the picture, but it is likely not a complete defense for these crimes.
And that's what makes it tricky in something like this, because it may be a moral failing. It may be an awareness failing, maybe a parental failing, not necessarily a legal failing. But sometimes, you know, those sort of things can then the domino effect happens and then something bad happens because the warning signs were not heeded. It doesn't necessarily make someone, you know, criminally liable or a horrible person, but something where they would look back on it in hindsight going, yeah, maybe I should have, you know, done this differently or handled this better. But it's hard to litigate anything like that. Extremely hard to litigate anything like that because it's nothing illegal necessarily is always going on in situations like that. What this case makes me think about more than anything else is how the only reason we're talking about it is because she's dead and it happened in international waters on a cruise ship. How many cases like this are happening every single day in homes all across America, in families, you know, that, you know, mixed families from another marriage, kids from two different blended families, where you have this sort of dynamic going on and the parents are so hell-bent on where everything's good, everything's happy, we're a happy family, everything's normal. And, you know, and the insular part of that keeps the stories from getting out. How many young people suffer in silence in situations where the blended family comes into play and nobody is hearing their screams or their cries for help or just basic conversation, please, of, hey, I feel uncomfortable around this person. Well, suck it up. You know, you just got to get along. You got to do this. You know, those are words that so many generations have been told as they grow up. You'll get through it. You just got to, you know, buckle up. I feel like this really shines a light in this area and in an area where Anna Kempner's not rare. Parents like this aren't rare. I'd call them pretty average, quite honestly, for their level of care or their level of reaction to information like that comes through. You would hope it would be better, but I don't think it truly is on a whole. Does this bring more light to that? Because I feel like it really should.
You know, this sort of familial strife has been going on since the dawn of time. You look sure. at, you know, Cain and Abel, the story in the Bible. Yeah. This kind of thing is not new. And certainly to your point, when it comes to blended families and trying to make that adjustment, that's difficult for nearly anyone. And I think that oftentimes the parents want to have this rosy view of things that, and also perhaps they've sort of deluded themselves into saying, hey, if I just sort of view this as everything's okay, we're going to get through it, then that's what'll happen. And sometimes that's to the detriment of these kiddos who are voicing concerns. In the comments, someone mentioned how Anna Kempner may have voiced a concern to her father. That was a safety-related concern. And what was done? They put them on a cruise where they could be alone in a room together. You know, these are problematic scenarios and has led to an extremely tragic outcome in this case.
Yeah. I mean, other than being more vigilant and listening to your kids when they're telling you, I'm uncomfortable, there's something wrong here, this is not going to be okay, listening to them. Had that been done and not, well, she had the option to go stay with her grandparents. Yeah, she had to inconvenience them. It wasn't just like, of course, we're going to give you your own space. You're an 18-year-old girl. We don't want you to be in a room with, you know, hormonal 16-year-old who's already shown a penchant for trying to do things to you sexually, allegedly. What could possibly go wrong? It just seems like there's a lot of things that were completely ignored or willfully ignored because the parents I don't know. I mean, on the surface, it appears didn't want to deal with it. That's the observation I'm making, but that may not be exactly how it truly went down in their minds.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I was distracted. What I was doing, I was looking it up. So roughly the FBI data on the, in general, it's about 100 to 200 sibling on sibling murders a year across the country.
Gotcha. If you're that's interested. That's a sizable figure.
It's bigger than you'd think it is, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah,
it is. doesn't include step siblings. They don't break it out for step sibling, but it's sibling on sibling. It's 1 to 200 a year.
I really wonder what the numbers are on SA that are unreported. I mean, because you're not going to get it because it's unreported. But the number on SA between step siblings. Especially in the culture that we live in. I mean, there's a whole industry to this theme that exists in the adult industry, and when you have young dumb males. That are seeing this sort of thing, and it's somehow normalized in the culture to what they're consuming. That's a scary place for young women.
You know, and Tony, you brought up an interesting thing right there when you said the essay, and I'm very so. Here's again, we're doing a lot of conjecture and hypothesis,
innocent
until proven guilty, mm-hmm. but. What we've heard in this case, and Eric, correct me if I'm wrong, and Tony too, I think there was SA in this case too, correct?
Yeah, that's what, since he's been charged as an adult, that's what's
so here's a scary fact on this. I remember, Tony, when you and I covered a case a couple years ago now of an SA of a sex worker. And when I looked at the stats on this, roughly for every one conviction of a serial SA perpetrator, there are roughly 400 that are undiscovered. So I'm curious as to whether the family or anyone knew of other potential cases that would be uncovered if they dug deeper. Because if he had this one, what's the likelihood and probability there might be more? Again, pure hypothesis, pure conjecture. But since you brought that up, very, very rarely is SA one and done. It's either the very beginning of a long road or somewhere in the middle of it. So just something to think about.
Yeah. And would we get that answer? I mean, there's a vested interest in the people who are in that house to not, even if they had knowledge of something like that, to not share that piece of info, because then that would reflect directly on the parenting and an unsafe environment.
I wonder if anything else will come forward on that too. That's a scary, horrible thought, and I'm sorry for it, but it's out there as a possibility, I guess.
Again, this is my opinion. I'm not saying that the parents did anything criminal or anything like that, but it really is a cautionary tale when we look at it of parenting that is derelict parenting, in my opinion, or parenting that just is not in touch with what's going on around them and the lives of these little humans that you have in your world that aren't so little anymore. They're young adults. They're capable of really horrible things if they want to be, and putting your head in the sand and hoping for the best. And in many cases, you know, kids grow up, they get through it. They can go through a lot of therapy later to talk about the shit that was ignored. But a lot of people survive. But this is obviously one that did not.
And how many cases we keep – I mean, so look at the overlap we keep hitting on our cases. You know, whether it's the Duggars and FLDS or IBLP with them, it keeps coming down to teenage adolescents without guardrails doing crazy crap because their hormones are running amok and they're nut jobs and grooming, and bad crap happens because there's zero guardrails, zero accountability, and this is what keeps happening, and it's crossing all these different areas.
Yeah, I think it comes down to parents failing to recognize their children as humans, as individuals,
and getting off your ass and being a parent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 1,000%. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in right there. And press subscribe wherever you're getting podcasts. You don't miss any of the cases we're covering. Let's go to another one. Asa Alrip shared a home with Rex Heuermann for nearly three decades, roughly 1,300 square feet. It wasn't big. A secured room that had a metal door in the basement. And prosecutors alleging some of the murders may have happened inside while she was away. Asa's hair, his ex-wife, her hair was found on multiple victims. She called him her savior in a documentary, dismissed the planning documents originally as absurd, and said she'd need to hear it from him face to face before she believed it. Well, that's happened. She heard it, sitting in the courtroom when he pled guilty to 8 murders. Now, a civil lawsuit is forcing her to defend in court what she says she never knew. That's what we're going to be talking about. And your thoughts in the comment section as we work through it. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program with us. So is Eric Fannis, defense attorney and former prosecutor. Eric, Asa Elrup's attorney has said she was away every time one of these murders occurred, and prosecutors have backed that up. It appears that, yeah, legitimately, that was the schedule. It seemed kind of ridiculous, I think, when we heard it originally, but that's what the timetable has shown us. But the civil complaint alleges she knew of, concealed, or consciously avoided learning. Consciously avoided learning. That's interesting. About what was actually happening here. As someone who's prosecuted these sort of arguments and defended against them, how strong is willful blindness as a claim against a spouse when even the prosecution says that she wasn't there?
You know, Tony, I surely understand these victims' families trying to seek redress through any avenue they can. But I read over the complaint this morning, and it is a stretch. It is a stretch legally. It's a stretch factually. Mm-hmm. You know, just alleging someone's willful ignorance, that's usually not sufficient to have them be held responsible in the criminal side, certainly not in the even in the civil side with a lower burden and everything. Just mm-hmm. the fact that she, you know, maybe tried to put her hands over her ears or something, that doesn't somehow make her legally responsible for these deaths. So I think they're kind of reaching here a lot mm-hmm. on the plaintiff's side.
Yeah. There is a pattern here with this. I mean, there's a documented history of this sort of thing happening in other cases. Gary Ridgway's wife lived with him for over a decade, had no idea what was going on. BTK's wife was married to him for over 30 years, completely blindsided. Elrup's situation does fit that pattern. And in a civil trial, can the defense put these up as evidence of prior cases where similar type things were going on? Can they put those cases in front of a jury to reframe her for from a co-conspirator to a victim? And does that sort of precedent in history have any sort of weight?
So defense would have to get creative in order to do that. I think they would have to get some kind of mental health expert or behavioral expert. Robin, hey, they might hire you on this to talk about behavioral and psychological and personality patterns of folks who are in the same position as the wife here, Asa. And if they did, they could probably reference, you know, here's why we think this. We look at these prior cases and we look at the position that those folks were in. Asa's in the same position here is what the defense may argue through an expert. Now, will the court allow that? That would be a bit unorthodox, but it's very possible that information could get in front of a jury and they could say, hey, compared to these other cases, it seems like this defendant was in the same boat.
So I'm also curious, Eric, you know, they're going after her civilly, yet they don't, outside of whatever they may have made on the Peacock special for her going on and telling her story, we don't know exactly how much she made on that. The family, it does not look like they have a huge number of assets. Why else would you do it? So if she didn't go on that show and potentially make money from that, what would they really gain out of prosecuting her and trying to go down the civil road?
It's a good question, Robin. In the complaint, they do talk about a claim for unjust enrichment, essentially saying that Asa should not have received money and profited off of deaths of which they claim she was aware and perhaps had some involvement in concealing. But besides that piece of it, what's the payoff for the plaintiff? Is it closure? Is it justice in their eyes? Perhaps. But the monetary piece of this, you know, how is the attorney going to get paid? If the attorney, if there aren't significant damages on the line, you know, they have to work out these practical issues in terms of legal representation. Is it just, you know, fame and notoriety for the attorney? I don't know. There are these intangibles that could be being sought by the plaintiffs that are perhaps non-economic.
I mean, and unjust enrichment is, I mean, that I get if, you know, Huerman was trying to write a book, I mean, or like OJ did, if I did it. That's why we have laws like that for the actual people who commit the crimes from the Son of Sam laws from trying to get rich off of their own doings. It doesn't necessarily apply to victims. It's about the perspective as to which you're looking at this. Is Asa a victim? By all standards of criminal law, she is. Civil is a different world. Opinion, the public opinion, is a different world because it's just that. It's an opinion, and civil tends to go more towards the world of public opinion. So if someone is looking at her as, you know, another victim of Rex Huerman, completely blindsided, she's there spending her life. She spent her life with this person. You know, some may say you wasted your life with this person, considering what the outcome has been. She would have every right, just as anyone else would, to tell her story, which she did in that documentary. And she was very honest about it. She wasn't sitting there using that documentary as necessarily as a woe me. And she wasn't necessarily, you know, saying the victims are liars or horrible people. She was saying she believed at that moment in time that she thought he was innocent. Turns out she was wrong. She's accepted that already. Is there anything wrong? I mean, if this lawsuit were to be successful against her for unjust enrichment, does that set a precedent going forward for other folks who might find themselves in the throes of another member of their household being a horrible human being, committing crimes, being blindsided to it, and then saying, yeah, I'll take $1 million to tell my story on Peacock? It's not that they did anything, but there's also nothing really wrong about telling your story either.
Totally, Tony. I mean, we see all these true crime documentaries that they're very popular right now, and it's often interviews with people who were sort of crime adjacent, that they mm-hmm. were near, they were privy, right. that they had perhaps information or at least experiences. But also, what could come into play here that I don't think anyone's talked about is Austin might have a First Amendment right to tell her story. And even though this is a civil context, there are cases that talk about if there is a claim brought in the civil world and the court essentially administers the deprivation of a person's First Amendment right by overseeing the case and enforcing a judgment against that person when doing so would violate the First Amendment, I think there's a potential First Amendment defense
here.
And it really goes to the principle that, hey, we all, as a general rule, should be able to tell our story. Now, if we offed a bunch of people, shouldn't be able to make money on that. But if it's just a witness or someone who is just in that world, they probably have that right still.
Mm-hmm. Do you think her thinking that and proclaiming so profusely on that special how he's innocent and her entire context of him, do you think that helps or hinders her case?
I think that it could go both ways, but I think defense is going to say, hey, this is consistent with someone who just had no knowledge. My gosh, if you were married to somebody and you truly didn't know about their misdeeds, you would probably take the position that, hey, everything I have seen indicates that this spouse, my guy, is innocent. And that's consistent with someone who is sort of oblivious and doesn't have a true knowledge of the gruesome details that have come to light since then.
Yeah, I agree.
This has to go to trial yet in a civil case. What is the judge going to be looking at here? Could this get thrown out before we get to an actual civil trial here? Does a judge still have to make a ruling on that, or is this on a green light to actually get in front of a jury?
I think that there is a reasonable likelihood that this case might be dismissed. When I read the complaint, basically what the plaintiff is claiming is that the wife, Asa, had some knowledge and then was either willfully ignorant of other facts and or helped aid and abet, helped conceal, helped Rex somehow get away with this. In my appraisal, the complaint is pretty scarce as to the precise details, as now Asa allegedly did that. And so I think that it's pretty thin. A judge might see it as somewhat flimsy and might say, hey, look, if you're going for a wrongful death case, you got to go against the person who caused the death, not just this peripheral actor who might have been caught up in it. And so there's a chance this case doesn't get to the trial phase because the judge throws it out.
Do you think there's going to be multiples on this for other victims as well?
It's possible, you know, there's also a statute of limitations issue that's arising. You know, usually you can only bring a wrongful death claim within 2 years, I believe, in New York of the incident happening. Now, there are exceptions. There are exceptions for if the claimant, the child, was a minor when that statute run. There are exceptions for newly discovered information, things like that. But I think there's a chance that a lot of these claims might be barred by the statute of limitations, even if someone were to view them as valid.
Right. It's an interesting case and one that does require some critical thinking. We've been soaking ourselves in this case for several years now. So we've been able to, you know, absorb a lot of it. And I remember early on in this case, when I first heard about the Asa dynamic, I think my initial gut reaction was bullshit. She didn't know anything. Today, I don't feel that way because I've done critical thinking. I've heard more about it. I've listened to what she's had to say. I've watched the doc and everything that's come out. And my opinion is not that. I think she was a victim here, too, in my opinion. I don't think everybody would be that. I think just she had the makeup, her history, her past, her mind, the way she processes information. All of it seems to be logical that she willfully did not know any of this information. And maybe willfully is the right thing. Not that she knew exactly what was going on, but maybe I don't want to know this about my husband. There's certainly secrets over here that he can keep, but not necessarily thinking that he's doing this sort of thing. But that does require a bit of critical thinking. And if you're going for a jury that doesn't know a lot about this case, that's a lot of information to take in a short period of time and get there. If this reaches a jury, the plaintiff puts a photo of a 1,300 square foot house with a metal door in the basement and asks if 12 people believe a woman lived there for decades and missed everything. The defense puts up a woman battling cancer whose own daughter didn't know, who cooperated fully with law enforcement, and who sat in a courtroom and heard her ex-husband confess. You've been on both sides. Which argument do you think wins if this actually does make it in front of the jury?
Tony, you know, there is no legal obligation for a spouse to investigate their partner, try to learn every single bad act that person did, and then go tell the authorities or go try to bring about some action because of it. I think that's kind of what the plaintiff in a perfect world would hope, but that's not the law. And so I really think that Asa, the wife, has a strong legal defense in this case. I think that in addition to everything we've talked about, there's something called the intervening cause doctrine, where Asa's going to say, hey, even if I had some information, maybe I should have done something different, but I didn't cause this. I didn't do this. And when the intervening cause is so material, so profound to the damages occasioned, sometimes a judge will say, hey, things are too attenuated here. You're going after the wrong person. I think for a number of reasons, the wife also wins this case.
I also think it's interesting because we've talked about this numerous times too, is Rex chose her very specifically to be a partner because he could maintain the facade he needed with someone who wasn't going to ask a lot of questions, who didn't have a lot of curiosity, that put him on a type of pedestal that allowed him to hide the way he wanted to hide and keep the secrets he wanted to keep. I think that's going to be part of it as well, just because, you know, she was taken advantage of by him. And she might have married him for better reasons than he married her, without a doubt.
Is there a reason we haven't seen other lawsuits against Asa civilly? Is it because other attorneys have said, yeah, that's going to go nowhere?
That's my apprehension, is that, you know, in looking over the complaint, I just think that it is such a stretch. It's such a reach. And if I was an attorney reviewing it, I'd probably say, for a number of reasons, that I would decline it. One is on the merits. I just don't think legally you're going to win that case against ASSA. Two, practically speaking, you know, how is the, like I said, how is the attorney going to get paid? Who knows how much funds ASSA actually got from this and how much has been spent since then? There's probably a very limited amount of assets still presently available. And an attorney might say, hey, this is not worth, you know, a 4-year legal saga if we're going to make it out of here with $30,000.
Unless it's not about the money and it's about the notoriety. Which,
Could be.
Yeah. I don't know. Who knows? We'll find out. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in there. And we'll continue our conversation there in the comments. Eric Faddis, as always, thank you for joining us. Great conversation. Robin's book, It's Not All About Me. It is available wherever you get books, Amazon, wherever you can find it. Go and check that out. All right. Until next time, for Eric, Robin, and Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
By law, 21 plus, terms and conditions apply.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.